can give yourself to and pour yourself out to. Young men, let me make a suggestion to you. Why don't you turn off the computer and log off the porn and go ask a real woman on a date? How about that? Just a thought. Ask her out. Young men, why don't you be the ones who do the asking? How about that? Don't wait for her. You go ask. Show her a little respect. And then you take her out and you treat her right. How about that? Don't make her cater to your whims. Treat her right. Treat her right. Treat her like what she is, a woman. A person of incredible significance created in the image of God. And you know what? You treat her right. And then one day you do her the honor and show her the respect of asking her to marry you. And then you go get married. And you have children.
Keep them right. And as far as I'm concerned, that includes not forcing them to carry pregnancies to term that they don't want to. Hello, David. I'm Matt Leck. This is Left Reckoning. How are you?
Hey, brother. No, that was just giving me some flashbacks to like a very particular kind of youth pastor who's a little bit too interested in who's dating who and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
It's like it's nothing like going to a youth group and getting. I remember very vividly being about 13 years old at church, and a woman was like saying, blowjobs are actually sex, and you'll go to hell if you get a blowjob too. There's a reason they call it blowjobs and not flossing your teeth. And to this day, that it's horrible. It's anti-sex. It also makes me laugh.
That's very funny.
But so folks, we have a sexy show for you this evening. We're talking about free speech and workplace safety, the two sexiest things. And we just happen to have Xander Corvus and Summer Hart to discuss those things with us, two leftist adult film stars.
Yeah, no, I was really happy to interview them, and I can't wait for folks to listen. I think we touched on a lot of important stuff, I think.
We talked with them for an hour and 20 minutes, which means that actually you're going to hear.
It's actually our longest interview we've ever done on this show.
We just kind of kept going, and so you're actually going to get 50 minutes of that, and we'll have the whole thing uploaded uncut. On YouTube for everybody afterwards, so you can watch the full thing. But and there's some really good stuffs that we didn't that won't be on this show that people should check out, including Xander talking about like inclusion of trans women in major sites and things like that I think are really worth hearing. So I was thankful for their time.
No, for sure. And yeah, we got a fun show coming up. We're going to be talking about some rough topics, but some bad news out of Alabama. And we'll end the show with a little bit of wisdom from Mick Lynch. In the post game, you get access to that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got some more crypto debunking coming. Some very exciting insights from super smart boy Tim Pool and friends. And we'll be taking your calls and questions there as well.
We're going to, in the post game, you want to check out, there's going into Minnesota Representative Tom Emmer, who was actually very close to becoming governor of that state, and now he's a crypto bro in Congress. And there's a funny tale of the tape when I went through his tweets about, he basically says, don't blame all of crypto for the actions of Sam Bankman-Fried. And we'll get into his relationship with Sam Bankman-Fried.
Well, I think might as well dive in, Matt. We got a pretty hefty show. So we wanted to talk about something up top with folks, which is what's been happening, in Atlanta. This big fight over what is being called Cop City in Atlanta, and some very frightening and chilling moves by the government to try to ban protest. And I think we should be very clear about what we're talking about here. But just to set the stage, because we're going to talk mainly about this recent arrest of five individuals who are being charged with domestic terrorism, which is undoubtedly an attempt to try to chill people's right to be able to protest against things that their government is doing. But before we get into that conversation, I feel like it's very important to highlight what people are fighting against there. So what is Cop City? Atlanta has been consumed by a fight over whether or not a $90 million police training facility should be able to continue to be built, despite growing community opposition and questions about the purpose of the facility and the harm that it will cause, not just on the level of sending more police out onto the streets to terrorize folks, but on the environmental level too, because to do this, they are going to bulldoze over a very large, I think something like 250 acres of wooded area in Southeast Atlanta. And, you know, this is a part of the community that is utilized by people to get green space. It's important for the local environment in the sense of preventing, you know, rainwater spill off, clean air to people, you know, basic kind of things that you want to have in your neighborhood. And this has been pushed by the police. It's been rubber stamped by the city council in the city of Atlanta, despite significant political pushback from residents in the community. And I think really to set the stage, we have this sort of longer clip here, a really great report put out by AJ Plus, produced by Anna Cook, titled Police versus Atlanta, the Battle Over Cop City, to break down some of these dynamics.
During the few times the public did voice their concerns, the overwhelming majority expressed opposition.
Me as a black woman living in Atlanta, that's no place for me if we got a cop city going on.
In fact, one hearing in September 2021 lasted for 17 hours, where around 70% of comments were against cop city. Regardless, city council passed the plan in a 10-4 vote.
What is going on with the city? Ordinarily, you would have a city who has control over the police. In this case, the police have a control over the city.
So why did council members approve this facility? It's important to understand the Police Foundation in Atlanta. It's considered one of the most powerful police foundations in the country. For instance, when the mayor was elected, the CEO of the foundation served on his transition committee. Among those sitting on its board are leaders of corporations like UPS, Wells Fargo, Chick-fil-A, Home Depot, and Delta Airlines. The APF raises investments to finance police projects like Cop City. Of the $90 million needed to build the facility, $60 million will be funded by the foundation's corporate donors. The remaining $30 million will likely be paid by taxpayers. Well before the council voted on the facility, the Police Foundation had been lobbying council members. And the cost? The city leased the land to the foundation for just $10 per year for the next 50 years. Two of the council members who approved the plan agreed to sit down for an interview.
Why did you vote to approve this facility?
It's going to be a big recruiting tool.
We have a duty, I think, and an obligation to provide our employees with the best in class of everything.
But you also have an obligation to listen to what the community is saying, right? Do you feel like you've done that?
Yes, I feel that I've done that. I'm a citywide representative. I move around the city constantly.
There were multiple chances for the public to speak. I've never been to a neighborhood planning unit meeting or a neighborhood meeting where I have been told, we don't want this.
So why here?
One, it isn't what I see as a quote-unquote forest, especially not an old-growth forest. If you go out to the land, which I've been to many times, there's a lot of invasive species.
But those who frequent the park daily say it's brought unique value to the neighborhood.
So to them, it may not be a forest, but to somebody else, it does mean something. The saying is true, one man's junk is another man's treasure. But these are the same individuals who don't even live in the community. They don't live in the community. They don't care. What they care? They don't care at all. These same city councilmen, would you allow it in your community? Would you allow this to take place in your community? Would you allow a landfill to be built in your community? Would you allow a police academy of this magnitude to be built in your community?
The answer to that is no. I mean... This is one of those things that touches on so much, right? What this fight is about, the police and whether or not people feel comfortable with these, you know, armed vigilantes in their community. They note in later in that documentary, which people should check out. You know, Atlanta is a heavily surveilled city, and I know just right here in Austin, there's fights about how much surveillance we should allow the police to have over people who are residents of those communities. It goes into this other dynamic in this country that we've seen since the George Floyd protests. you know, where a lot of people felt that something new was going to come out of that. But what ended up happening, more often than not, you saw police budgets increase instead of decrease, despite the fact that there's lots of popular will to do something different with policing in this country, right? We can debate about what we want to see and all that kind of stuff, but there's no doubt at this point that people don't like the idea of people who are above the law roaming around their communities. There's the environmental questions, which I think is no small factor here either. You know, about eradicating public space, right? Eradicating green space to be utilized for an occupying force, you know, to be able to train to wage war on, you know, on civilians. And even in that clip, you see that this is fundamentally, too, like a question of democracy, right? Yeah. People are outraged by this. The city council is doing something different. And not only do they not have the, you know, the balls to say, I'm doing this because I think this is the thing I want to do. They're saying, oh, no one's really mad about this. I'm not hearing anything about this, which either tells me you're outright lying or you're not listening when people are speaking to you.
Hey, that's exactly it. Like, who decides whether it's a forest? Is it the cops and the developers, or is it the community that actually lives there? And they know it's bullshit, which is why they had to include the thing about invasive species, because they know that just saying, oh, we're the like owners and cops, we're the city, we can do what we want. They say, oh, there's actually a reason. Well, if there's some invasive species, then the community can work with, you know, folks to rehabilitate that green space so there's no invasive species in there with some of that, you know, $30 million that you're putting toward, you know, fake apartments that you can kick the doors down.
But it's a bizarre argument. What he's trying to get at is that, like, this is like a newer forest, so it doesn't have any, you know, need for historical preservation or whatever. Nonsensical argument.
I don't care if you're a month ago.
I totally agree. And also, like, just saying, I'm sure it's similar in other parts of the country, but, like, if you're in the South, you know one thing. There's an invasive species that you cannot get away from there, which is called kudzu. Which grows incredibly fast. And if you drive through a lot of particularly state highways in the South, the entire side of the road is covered in kudzu, because it's an invasive plant that has just basically like strangled most of the wildlife in the state and in the region. And like, to make the argument is what I'm saying, that like, oh, invasive species, it, you know, therefore means we can do whatever the fuck we want with it. It's including a lot of land in the South, just knowing how much invasive species have sort of populated the area since the 60s, 70s.
I mean, I just think it's so obvious. Like, you have this space here that you walk your dog at, and all of a sudden the cops are going to take it over to, you know, run drills in. And think of the atmosphere that's going to create around there then. Like, that's a completely unuseful space all of a sudden, someplace to be avoided as opposed to, like, an outlet that the community, like, values.
Well, Matt, you'd love this. I didn't include it in the clip we played, but... you know, the police heard the concerns of the community, and they're going to turn a segment of that into a walk-in space. So you can walk by the facility where they're training police officers to kill unarmed folks, and, you know, and enjoy some nature and maybe a couple gunshots in the background.
That sounds like a great vibe. Yeah. That's where I want to go relax.
It's cynical all the way through, and there's a lot of organizations who have been pushing and fighting back against this. I know people in Atlanta have been really trying to make this a larger issue, and I've been surprised after this most recent news that there hasn't been more attention paid to it. Because sort of fast forwarding to this past week, you know, in addition to community organizations, you know, that are doing things like showing up to meetings, doing things like having street protests, there has also been a tactic of occupation of a small group of folks, but they've been occupying this area that is, you know, has been selected to be bulldozed over and occupying the land and living in tree houses there, trying to they call themselves forest defenders. And the occupation has been going on for months, and there have been multiple clashes with the police officers. But these have escalated recently. And last week, five of these forest defenders were arrested and charged with, quote, domestic terrorism. And I want to talk about that specifically. This is from the CNN report on this. Yesterday, several people threw rocks at police cars and attacked EMTs outside the neighboring fire stations with rocks and bottles. task force members used various tactics to arrest individuals who were occupying makeshift tree houses. The individuals have been charged with a variety of crimes, including domestic terrorism. Now, let's just be very clear about scale here. Because when the police have been attacking these occupations with chemical weapons, when police have been showing up masked, armed, and, you know, filled with body armor, I don't want to hear about any tales about rocks. Just bullshit, frankly. And this goes into a long fight from the right wing to try to outlaw protests in this country. Now, I'm not going to get into all of this, you know, the entire history of what's happened there. People have heard us talk about what kind of protest tactics we think work and which ones don't. You know, so you can cite that or look at that if you want to hear our opinions on these things. Are there tactics that maybe have been used that, like, maybe Matt and I don't feel like are the smartest or most strategic to be using? Maybe. Right. But if there was anything that comes up to the level of breaking the law, there are laws on the books for that. Tacking on a domestic terrorism charge takes it to a different level, right? So if you're saying that they're doing things like they've been, you know, accused of starting fires, things like that, there are rules and laws on the books that you can charge people for with that, right? If that is the extent of the unruliness, that's there. Mm-hmm. To go on domestic terrorism has one goal and one goal only, and that is to try to stifle and outlaw protest in this country. And that has been something that has not started here. It's been a long time process in this country, but it's really ramped up over this past decade from, you know, attempts to try to make protest illegal around things like Occupy all over the country, to the most recent reaction from GOP-run state legislatures across the country in response to the George Floyd protests to make it legal for someone to hit somebody with their car if they're engaged in a street protest.
Yeah.
We're seeing a very, very clear move by the right wing in this country to outlaw protest, using unpopular examples sometimes to justify them. And as a citizen of a supposedly free country, you have to be outraged at the state to make this kind of overreach.
Yeah.
Because this is not just a threat to the lives of these folks who are charged with it. It is a threat to your democratic rights to be able to protest. And in the context here where the city government is refusing to listen to the people, to engage democratically with the citizens, and are much more interested in listening to the police, much more interested in listening to board members of Chick-fil-A, you know, et cetera. You know, it's not surprising that people are taking outside action to try to make their voice heard. And it creates a very, very dangerous situation when the state is basically trying to create an opportunity for them to justify any actions that they want to take against protesters. Yeah. If you agree with their tactics or not, right? And that's the fundamental point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would feel the same. Like, we have this situation around the country right now at this exact same time where fascists are intimidating people around drag queen story hours, mm-hmm. And things like of that nature. Now, I do not want to see those people get hit with terrorism charges either. I'd like you said, get charged with the laws that are already on the books for the types of things that they are committing. That said, that's a lot more close to terrorism than whatever this is. Who are you terrorizing? People that want a cop academy? Please. That's mm-hmm. unserious in the extreme as far as I'm concerned. The only way that's consistent is when you know the secret sort of state definition of terrorism, which is, you know, actions that go against the main national security state that we care about. But by any normal, rational person's understanding, like, this is not terrorism. And any sort of property damage or sabotage is the sort of thing that I wouldn't, like, encourage people of our audience to take that risk of charges. But at the same time, like, I'm not going to be here condemning people or going out of my way to do things like that. I just think, like, these terrorism charges are ridiculous, and there's already laws that you can deal with different types of actions.
And look, I mean, you know, just going back to what you're saying about the right wing in this country, where, you know, even the FBI is saying, like, the greatest threat right now is coming from white nationalists and the right here. You know, where is that activity and interest from state governments in dealing with that problem in this way? It's not there. All right. They're much more worked up about people living in trees, you know, trying to prevent a forest from being bulldozed over than people who have made credible threats and acted on those threats to harm U.S. citizens.
And they're worried about that, those tactics getting a victory in the public eye over a cop academy, which I think also like is something that they're going to go pretty far to try to. And that's where you see the sort of escalation.
Nor is there any interest from governments in dealing with the fact that across the country right now, many police departments are acting in a rogue fashion. Right.
Right.
They are denying orders from city government officials in New York City, where Matt's at. You know, they were straight up doxing and threatening the daughter of the mayor. Right. Who was a very limp character. It's not like De Blasio was some yeah. kind of freedom fighter or anything like that. It was just unacceptable to them to see any kind of pushback from elected officials or members of their family. And those are people who are armed. Those are people who have military equipment and, you know, are supposedly supposed to be there to serve the general public and maintain safety. And you've seen from places like Austin, places like New York, places like Atlanta, Minneapolis, et cetera. You can go down the whole list that there is very little worry from the government here about trying to hold those folks who have, you know, the ability to shoot and kill people, you know, to account. And there's a lot of worry about people trying to protest to make sure that you're listening to communities.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing I'd quibble with from that Al Jazeera clip is like, he's like, normally the city is in charge of the cops. It's like, no. I mean, and that's unfortunately something we have to come to terms with in our democracy is that cops and the corporations, like we like that video helpfully pointed out, that are hand in hand like are above democratic control, and that is a task that we all need to like be clear about and begin.
So we'll keep our eye on that and keep folks updated, and always, you know, people, especially folks who are in the Atlanta area, you know, reach out, let us know what's going on. We definitely do, you know, want to hear from y'all, and are, you know, always happy to try to cover these things. That, I mean, amazing to me, this hasn't gotten more national attention, frankly. But that's the way it goes. Well, we're going to jump over to our interview in just one second. I just want to remind folks about two quick things. We're going to be in New York City with our good friend Ben Burgess, Jason Miles, Mr. Matt Leck, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland, Bhaskar Sankara. At the Cutting Room Floor on January 22nd for Left is Best Fest or Left is Best Live, whatever you want to call it. It's going to be a hell of a lot of fun. I'll put the link below for people to grab tickets. Just letting you know, we're selling this one pretty quick, particularly the meet and greet tickets. I think we only have a handful of those left. So definitely if that's something you're interested in, it's time to snag them while you can. Really looking forward to that. And, you know, Matt, it's Christmas over the weekend. So just want to remind folks that if you're looking for something, it might not get there before the date, but you can always, you know, print out a picture. We have our LR store here. You got your LR on the road shirt. Look at that beautiful boy. Left Reckoning trucker cap and our Big Tex tank. You can get that on our website, leftreckoning.com. All that stuff really helps us keep growing and moving forward. But yeah, man, should we jump over to this? So just for people who joined us recently, do you want to set this up and let them know about
yeah,
how they can get the full one since we can't play the full one right now?
Tonight, around maybe by the time we get done with the post game, we'll publish in full the full hour and 20-minute discussion we have here. This is the first 55 minutes and the like very end with their plugs for Suede Las Vegas. Their mutual aid group we'll link to that. I'll also try to remember to link to that in these comments too when that goes live, so people can check out the full thing and share it. So without further ado, we'll be back with another segment at the end of this to wrap up before the post game, but we'll see you folks in about 55 minutes. All right, welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, brother. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm pleased to be joined from Las Vegas, Summer Hart and Xandra Corvus, adult film stars, and also do work with SWAID, Sex Workers Mutual Aid Fund in Las Vegas. Summer and Xander, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get into sort of broader labor issues and things like that, I'm just curious about your stories, and either one of you feel free to start. Like, getting political, I imagine it's probably easy to go through entertainment careers without getting political. It's probably maybe some sort of
probably helpful, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, what has sort of brought this out of you guys?
I mean, I would say this isn't my only career I've ever had, but I would tell you that I've had a lot of social work and like community organization background, where I've worked with a lot of people who I noticed maybe were not having the problems that people decided they were having. Like, maybe they weren't having mental health problems, but they actually have problems with poverty. And that, like, the biggest issue that a lot of people seemed to face when we were trying to give them services was actually that they just lacked the funds to be able to do what they needed and get what they needed, like childcare or appropriate healthcare. And so, like, we use these approaches really frequently, where we're going to, I don't know, help people, but we're not going to help them in a way that's actually beneficial to them. So, like, what most people need is, like, to get a service or have money in their pocket or have something done for them. But there's all of these organizations. Like, I mean, I'll give you a really good example of this. It's like, there's all of these organizations, and they're nonprofits too, that are like, oh, well, your problem is you don't know how to budget. And it's like, that's not the people's problem. People's problem is that they're being exploited. They make very little money, and then they have to try to make all of that work. And then we make these organizations, create these organizations to help them, where we tell them that they just don't know what they're doing. And I'm telling you right now, poor people are the most resourceful people. They could tell you how to do things that people who have money would not even fathom how to do. And then, of course,
I would say the same thing about, like, I'm an addict, and I would say the same thing about addicts. Like, addicts are the most resourceful people. Mm-hmm. Yes. And they often don't have a lot of money, so that's, you know.
Yeah, and I worked in a rehab, like, I've worked all these different places that are, like, social service sectors, right? And this was, like, my common experience. Like, the person who I'm sitting with often didn't struggle with, like, a mental health problem or addiction or whatever, so much as they struggled with, like, poverty and the issue of poverty that made them very sick.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't occur to me in preparation for this that the sort of paternalism, both in, you know, pornography as a genre of entertainment and how we deal with major societal problems that somehow don't seem to actually get addressed. I mean, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Xander, how about you? How and specifically, just for our sakes, how did you come to find the sort of Left is Best Michael Brooks show universe?
Well, it was through the Majority Report first. I started watching that with, back when Michael was on there and Jamie and y'all and the whole thing. And I got really into that. Really, it was just because I think I started getting sent videos of, like, Ben Shapiro and stuff like that by one of my friends who have actually converted back since then, which is pretty
love
awesome.
To hear it.
I'm hoping about that. Yeah, and he went down a pretty crazy path for a minute there. But, you know, he was sending me a lot of these, like, facts and logic destroyed fucking videos. And back then I was like, yeah, like, haha, like, whatever, that's funny. But, you know, I always held these beliefs in my mind. Like, I'll remember, God, when I was like 10, when Obama was in office. No, God, 10? That's not correct. When was Obama elected? 2008?
2008, yeah.
2008.
He
can tell you it was the first presidential election I voted in. So
yeah, me too. Not 10. But yeah, so I remember right before Obama, when Obama was running, and I had said to my grandma something about, my mom's side of the family is hyper right wing. And so I had said to them about, they were talking about Medicare stuff. And I was like, yeah, I don't see any issue with, like, taxes going to, like, helping people who can't afford, you know, healthcare. Like, that's so messed up that that wouldn't be a thing. And, like, she went on this fucking crazy tirade about me being, she was like, you want to live in Soviet Russia? Like, is that what you want? And I was like, now as, like, an adult, I'm like, yeah, comrade, I am a fucking communist. Okay? Like, fuck you. Like, yeah, grandma, look what you made me. Like, I've always had those kind of beliefs in the background. I didn't really know what they were. Mm-hmm. And like, hats off to grandma for telling me, you know, what my beliefs were, I guess. But that was, you know, when I discovered like listening to y'all and listening to Michael and Jamie and Sam and all you guys, I found out that I was a leftist because I didn't know mm-hmm. what my beliefs were. It was the same as, you know, when I started working for kink.com, I didn't know shit about LGBT anything. I was, you know, grew up as a fucking bone ass poor kid in Ohio. And, you know, Ohio in the 90s was not quite the most, you know, liberal in that sense, I guess. Yeah. But you know, that was when I discovered all the things I now know about the LGBT community and all that. So really my journey was sculpted more in the right direction from TMBS and the Majority Report. Like, that was what got me to finally like start getting involved and actually understanding, you know, the politics of what I believe in inside myself, I guess.
I mean, I want to circle back to the kink.com stuff kind of in the latter half of the interview, because that is very interesting. Yeah. For me, I must say it's quite an experience. Xander called into Majority Report, I must have been like this fall, and putting the two together, because I'd seen sort of like Comrade Corvus on Twitter, and I'm familiar mm-hmm. with the work on Brazzers, but I never really put the two connections together. And then I'm like, oh, wait a second, that's the same guy. And I mean, it was very mind blowing. And I mean, I'll just say it's nice to hear people and like any of these stories, honestly, like where people, I mean, that Obama moment is so interesting because I think like that paranoia that people have, like this is a moment of socialism. Mm-hmm. Of course, we all know that Obama wasn't like actually a secret socialist, but that's what our generation, like that did like sort of give us a sort of off ramp into, but wait a second, like, right. Like, people shouldn't be going broke for healthcare and being in medical debt. If that makes me a socialist or communist, you know, so be it. And you do have comrades. So I just want to ask, like, ideologically, Xander, you consider yourself a communist?
I would, yes.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't have any qualms about saying that. Yeah. I mean, but that's the idea, right? The idea is... Yeah. You know, the socialism, communism, anarchism is like what it leads to, right? Like, we don't live in a world right now where communism as a broad thing could even be possible. It's more like a thing that I would love to see in the future. Like the Star Trek. Star mm-hmm. Trek is the best example you can really give anyone. It's like,
yeah,
that's what we could have. We could have that or Mad Max. You know what I mean? We're leaning toward Mad Max. But yeah, I think that's basically where my mind has always been.
No, I appreciate it. I think, you know, that we're the first generation. I think because of that Obama, we're the first generation to sort of like look at these things beyond a sort of Cold War a context and say, like, you know, imperialism is bad, and there's lots of things to be, you know, critical about of all sorts of like major nation world powers. but yeah, I appreciated that. So let's move on to another.
Does have to do with the internet, though, because back before the internet, back before like mass communication, you know, our parents just learned, you know, evil communists and socialists and. John Birch Society?
Yeah, Birch Society, yeah.
Yeah, you ever hear that Bob Dylan song about that? It's amazing.
It's a great song, yeah.
Such a great song.
My favorite Dylan, yeah.
That's, yeah, me too. But that's, that and the Hurricane. But the whole, you know, that's what they were taught. That's what our grandparents were taught. And there was never, you weren't able to question that because you didn't have any counter narratives to, like, you know, there wasn't any real books available or anything like that for you to like look at about this kind of thing. You know, people say what they say now about Chomsky because he's kind of like doing the thing. But like, you know, you had Chomsky and Michael Parenti and all these guys from back then who were actually coming out and saying shit. But it was that shit was so hard to find. It was only because of YouTube that I've ever seen a fucking Michael Parenti lecture. Like, you know, so it was,
and I think
without the internet, we haven't gotten that.
Yeah, and we're of the age that we saw that that transit. Like, we experienced it both ways of having things very, like remember watching TV Guide? Here's what's coming up on C-SPAN. Maybe you can get, like, an interesting guy on Book TV or something. Yeah. Now you can just Google or YouTube all that stuff.
I mean, yeah. It was here, like, my Alex Jones was the guy on Public Access TV here in Austin when I was a kid, no. Which is pretty wild.
That's awesome.
You know, but I think you're right, though, the internet playing a good role in this stuff, because, like, you can start to put two and two together. Like, you know, I grew up around, like, a lot of conservatives. My family was more liberal, but, like, you know, I started, like, swimming the same streams as other folks. Then I would be like, well, you know, like, I do get my health care through Medicaid, and, like, the food that we have, we get through food stamps. So, like, actually, I sort of like these things. I don't think they're too much of a problem. And then finding doors that opened up to sort of help explain some of these things. It's like, no, those are good things that we should be fighting for. I think something that we got really lucky with, I think, in our generation, having those opportunities to sort of learn more, not have everything mediated through our, like, grandmothers and
folks like that. Well, and then they also use that same othering propaganda with that, like, you know, a family that is growing up on food stamps and whatnot, that's, you know, like, working hard and doing whatever they can. They have this target of this other family who's growing up on food stamps and all that stuff as their welfare queens, and they're not working as hard, and we deserve this, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's every time that we do have something that's good, they find a way to twist it into another othering and whatever thing there, and that's a clever tactic that they use. But yeah, I grew up, you know, Aldi, like, back in the day, it was like what we called the poor kids grocery store. That's where we got all our shit. Fruit is always good. We liked it.
Exactly.
Yeah, we grew up on all that stuff too.
I want to move to another topic that's on everybody's minds, and that's free speech, and get both of your perspectives on this. There's a sort of logic that gets deployed by people who often like to emphasize, you know, when racists are banned from social media platforms as, like, a big violation of free speech. It says, like, if you don't speak up for these guys, then don't, you know, come to us when it comes for you. And I always wonder, well, why doesn't this start with the porn? Because that seems to be, if we're starting to slippery slope, like, if me personally, I'm doing a platform, I'm going to allow nudity before I'm going to allow, like, racism personally. I'm just curious. Yeah. Like,
well, I mean, let's start there. Like,
yeah,
there's nothing inherently bad or wrong about people's naked bodies. And if you've been taught that, it's, like, through religion, and nothing wrong with religion, but, like, there's a lot of Abrahamic religions that teach specifically that women and women's bodies and women's sexuality are negative, right? And that their nudity is specifically wrong, and that it corrupts men, et cetera, and that they're responsible for men's behavior, right? And so, like, that's where we've been taught, like, nudity is bad. There's nothing anywhere close to nudity that has anything to do with, like, racism, right? Like, racism inherently is a structural harm that comes to people. Like, people are hurt in a multitude of ways by this, not just, like, emotionally. I think white people tend to, like, look at, sorry, I'm definitely white, I'm not saying that. White people like me tend to look at people in a current social and historical context, right, and say, like, oh, well, this is just now. What I'm saying is hurting your feelings. That's not what's happening. This person, who's almost all people of color, but, like, in the United States, people who are from marginalized groups tend to see themselves as part of this larger group with lots of historical baggage and grievances, and you're kind of, like, piling on top of it. It's not about your feelings in that moment or my feelings in that moment. It's about, like, a historical context of racism and things that have happened in the past, right? Those things are genuinely harmful to people and have actually caused people's deaths. Like, those are harmful things. Nudity doesn't hurt people. We are born naked, and there's nothing naturally bad or sinful about our bodies or sexuality. That's a natural human function. It's as natural as breathing or eating. Like, racism is something disgusting that humans invented.
Right.
Sexism.
But did it shock you to find out that there's things like shadow banning happening on Twitter?
I mean, when I first discovered it, yes.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Now, like, that I've, you know, now that I've actually dove into, you know, actually, like, sex worker rights shit and, like, I think for a long time I was just a drunk idiot who just wanted to make money and didn't really look or at the world around him. I was kind of just, you know, fumbling through all this stuff, like the porn industry and everything. And then once I actually dove into the, you know, like I was saying earlier, because of like my leftward awakening, you know, I started diving into more labor things and then realizing stuff about sex work and like, wow, we are really actually marginalized by these platforms, like a lot. Like I didn't realize I got, like my first time I got banned from Instagram in like, I don't know, like 2012 or some shit. And like it was a long time ago. And I was just like, haha, whatever. You know, I like posted something that was a little more risque. And I was like, haha, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But then now, knowing how that much that affects people's income and stability and like, you know, whole fucking life a lot of time. Like a lot of people, a lot of sex workers make a lot of their traffic comes from Instagram or Twitter and all this kind of stuff. Like a lot of it. And
and that's such an important point because like that's these platforms growing off of that. And they know that.
They know
that a certain amount of allowance of that is going to be very good for growing their platform. And then when it gets to a certain point, they can pull the rug out from under you guys.
That's an OnlyFans trend.
I mean that's every platform. I mean if you were to look at historic Tumblr, Twitter, OnlyFans, like it really wouldn't matter what we were talking about. The push is like get these people in here who get eyes and clicks and like that people like this content. They do like this content. But then, you know, we want to push it back. And actually a lot of that is rhetoric on the right. I'm sure that you know that like the Republican National Convention declared porn like a public health crisis. I mean, here's the thing, to live in a country where most people cannot access affordable health care, where people are literally dying of preventable illnesses, where we do not have as good a health care as, I don't know, like where's our lung cancer vaccine? They have it in Cuba. Like there's like if you
should really?
Yeah, that's pretty neat. Cuba, even though we like suppress them, literally harm them constantly, they actually have a higher literacy rate than we do, and they also have a lung cancer.
But socialism can't work.
Right. I mean, I I've never been to Cuba, but I know they have a higher literacy rate than we do, and they have a lung cancer vaccine. There are other countries that are much more democratically socialist than we are. They have a higher standard of living by every possible way that you could account for it. They have more freedoms, they have better health care, every measure that you could look for like what is a good life. Like they have more education, more health care, all these different things. But to sit in a country where this is the case and say that like porn is the public health crisis when there are literally people around you dying of preventable illnesses because they cannot access affordable or appropriate health care is insanity.
But we do have all these guns though. So that's
amazing. Figure out how to cure cancer with a gun.
But also, I'd be curious to.
cancer is also dead if you're dead.
The thing is too is with like the with censorship, and I'm just curious what y'all's thoughts are on this too. I mean, like, you know, having like these big platforms reduce like individual or like small collective groups of people being able to produce and like own their own content, it weakens those people as workers, right? Because then the only way to produce, you have to go to like big organizations or publishing groups, and you don't have that ability, to own your own labor, to sort of make sure that you're not getting like a nasty contract where other people own the rights to your content. You know, and it's not just sex work. I mean, it's like a lot of other independent media too, like what we do. Like, you know, if I were working for like a different kind of media firm, I'd have to censor what I'm saying. I wouldn't be able to investigate do the conversations I want to have. And those things get controlled by people who have money and invest in those things. And, you know, I feel like the consequences for sex workers is like especially dire when you see these kind of, you know, big platforms sort of like censoring them.
I would also tell you that, like, I feel like the media, social media stuff is only like half of our battle anyway. You know that like people doing perfectly legal work, and I'm not trying to throw people who might be doing less than legal work under the bus here, but people who are doing perfectly legal work get their Cash Apps, PayPals, Venmo. I've had it happen to me. And in fact, the first account that we had for Suede that was paying sex workers out mutual aid grant money was shut down within like 3 months. And so we've also had one of our Cash Apps shut down. Like people target these things because and we're completely pushed out of a lot of banking sectors, like entirely. I've known people specifically that have had their entire bank accounts frozen and investigated for months, so they couldn't. There's a lot of reporting on this, and there's a huge document that a bunch of sex workers of all different types have contributed to. And so we have to be extremely secretive. And like, if you have an LLC, you have an S corp, have a business, you can't just waltz up and say, yeah, well, this is an adult photography business, because the second you say something like that, they will take your bank accounts. And if they have any idea that you are using Cash App, Venmo, or PayPal potentially for these kinds of adult transactions, they'll take your money and never give it back to you. You'll never see it again. And so, like, yeah, I mean, I would really like it if, you know, I can abide by Instagram's rules probably, you know, if I'm like a really good citizen, cross my fingers, but like, right? I'm making a count, I don't know, but like, but it's really difficult to replace a bank account. Right. And even Suede went around, we had like three different people that we talked to, and we're not doing anything illegal or anywhere close to illegal by giving people money. And we talked to four different banks who were like, first of all, they did not like the idea of mutual aid. I don't know why, but if you said that word, they were like, and then we don't know what that is, and we don't like it. And you could never say like who this money was like going to, because that was also a problem. And we found this out immediately, and our accountant was just like, don't tell the bank.
You know, I just want to, maybe this is petty, but there's some folks who might think that cryptocurrency is the answer to that. And I just want to say the answer is postal banking, where you're covered by the First Amendment, and there should be like, you should be a right to bank that shouldn't be up to, you know, these financial institutions that have morality clauses and things like this to say, you know, that's icky.
Could you expand on that? What is that?
Postal banking is basically the idea that the post office will run basic deposits and savings and checking and that sort of stuff. And I don't know exactly. I know maybe you know specifics more, David, on like how savings works and interest and that sort of stuff. But it's not as geared towards speculation. It's basically, you know, what normal people want out of a bank, which is a place to put their money.
Basically, gamble with your money anyway, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And the thing is with the post offices, there's a post office everywhere in the country, and they can operate and do those kind of basic financial transactions that we want, like, you know, being able to put cash into a bank account, being able to write a check and all those kind of things, and have that be through the, you know, through the government, which, as Matt was saying, you know, it's not a private company, so it doesn't have the ability to say, like, we're not going to do this or that, you know, First Amendment protections. And, you know, because, like, you know, just apart from like free speech stuff, I mean, you know, so many working class people are sort of pushed out of the banking system. And in this country, it's really hard to get by without, you know, having access to checking. And then there's a whole nasty industry on top of that that preys on people, you know, if you've seen the cash checking companies and things like that. I mean, it's a huge industry, too. It's not just like on the margins. I mean, it makes a lot of money, these kind of really nasty firms that try to do that work for working class and poor people who don't have access to traditional banking. And yeah, it's something that you could do very easily. And there's been attempts in the past to do it and try to build these kind of public banks. And then the other thing, I mean, just if we're doing a quick pitch, like the other thing too, is that you can use that kind of money that like banks are like investing in like private firms so that they can make profits. But we could use things like public banking, which is a little different from postal banking, to do things that communities want, right? Like most cities don't have the budgets to do certain things. They're totally relying on taxes to do stuff like being able to publicly fund, you know, different kind of renovations and like that, things like that for a city. I mean, you know, this is just basic kind of stuff that makes a lot of sense to people when you explain it to them. The reason we don't have it is not because it's unpopular with people. It's because it's unpopular with financial interests.
Yeah. And I would just add, right, exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
If they just automatically took taxes out of things like that, even like that would save, because I know there's a lot of poor people. You know, growing up as a poor people, I understand. But, you know, there's a lot of people who can't afford to get their taxes properly done. Then the government takes a bigger fucking chunk out of that afterward. It's almost like they depend on people fucking it up so that they can get more money.
It's nickel and dime bullshit. This entire country is really just nickel and dime bullshit. And like, I mean, I say that about postal banking. And with regards to like your industry specifically, I mean, I would worry about Ted Cruz Mike Lee or something in putting in like a, well, we need to be super concerned about this industry banking for us. But I feel like that would be First Amendment protected. So, I mean, I would like to say that's our best bet.
you would feel like a lot of things would be First Amendment. Yeah, and the other thing, you mentioned something earlier, not to digress to a lot, but about the just the censorship stuff versus like racist Nazi shit on the on platforms versus like sex work stuff too. Like a lot of obviously the stuff that's going on right now with like Musk and all these fucking, you know, the things going on with Twitter and shit. There is this, like weird thing that people are doing about these people who love capitalism yet are trying to impose constitutional, like, basically to take control of a private corporation by saying like, oh, like Twitter has to be First Amendment rights, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, it doesn't, because you are the ones who want to let companies do whatever they want. But because things are being said that you don't like, now you want to bring the government, you want to bring that not big government in to fucking like oversee a company and what they decide they can do. You know what I mean? It's the same shit where like these right-wing people are like getting mad about, oh, the woke mob, and it's against my free speech. It's like, no, that's how free speech works. If you say some dumb shit, people are going to say some shit back. Like, it's not freedom from consequences. You know what I mean? Like, that's not what free speech is. It's like, if you say something horrible, expect other people to respond to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was just like a kind of thing that I thought of.
Well, I mean, it's all sort of very silly, like, especially in the wake of Elon Musk losing these polls on, you know, when he should reinstate journalists and if he should step down. So. I seen some of his like, sort of venture capitalist friends who always like sort of do his PR, like David Slack or whatever, being like, maybe the other Fortune 500 companies should be run by a popular vote too. And first of all, if you think, I agree with that. First, I would have one addition, which is that it's the workers, right? Like, I think, basically, like Twitter employees should be the ones that are making these edge calls. And they shouldn't be forced by a boss to be the ones to say like, oh, actually, we're going to allow this Nazi and we're not going to allow these boobs. And like, like that, if the employee, and like, to me personally, like, I think that's where a lot of this gets super confused. Because you act like, oh, we have to do all free speech, but we have two people here who know very well that these platforms do not adhere to that at all. They absolutely make all these sorts of calls for the good of the like feed or whatever, right? And and I mean, yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating. And the problem is like, there is a governmental sort of influence. These platforms are worried about either the Republicans getting power or the Democrats getting power and then coming down and regulating them. But to me, it's like, they kind of should have to. Like, should these companies be like, go into the, say, the next pandemic thinking, it doesn't matter what you promote or what gets to the front of page. If, even if it's like, say, drink your own urine and that's going to save you from the pandemic, if that's the most viral thing, I think Congress should be able to say like, hey, you know, we're going to call you to some sort of responsibility about that. Because I think, anyway, we're getting a little bit too far into the hypotheticals there, but let's talk about, speaking of pandemics, COVID, I know, did a number on porn. I'm curious, there's two dynamics to that. Like, one, you felt it as hard as anybody, the shutdowns, I think. And two, you also have a perspective on the importance of, other people taking their health seriously. Particularly getting infections and things like that. So I'm just curious, like how, what, like sort of reflecting on, that and, the recent stuff I saw you talking about with the swabs, just like lessons about, you know, nobody wanted this shutdown to end. We also need to look out for each other's safety and that sort of thing.
We just like at each other like, oh my god. Like, so obviously COVID was like devastating to anybody who had an in-person job where you had to interface with people, and there was, you know, some protections that would have been available for people in certain working positions like masks, or even these little clear shields and things like that that might have saved you from people's spit and the air they were breathing. That's not a thing on a porn set. And so like, we were testing and testing and retesting and testing for a couple of days and isolating and staying away from everybody and only on set. And, you know, I think I watched so many performers actually really take the health of other people more seriously than I saw the general public do. I don't know how many times I've been tested for COVID, like hundreds. And, you know, during that time, I feel like a lot of people, at least in my industry, were taking it really seriously. And not always, not all of them. I mean, don't get me wrong, but I watched a lot of people take that really seriously. And I'm watching a lot of people try to take what's happening now with us pretty seriously. I do want to emphasize this because I feel like I should say it every time we start to talk about porn. We are the most tested group of people in existence. Like, I don't know anybody else who goes in for blood and urine tests at a minimum every 14 days. And like, you know, it's funny, they wouldn't take my blood, right, at like a testing center. Like a what do you call those?
Blood donation.
Blood donation, yeah. Wouldn't want my blood. But like,
even though it's the most tested blood.
Yeah, but like, I can tell you right now that every 14 days for the last several years, I've been tested for HIV. And I've been tested with the most sensitive test in existence. Yeah. And so one of the reasons I want to talk about this is because I think that there's this idea that people who are doing porn are like spreading disease, or you're like, we have STIs, and this is just like patently false. Like, we are really, really good at not doing this. And in fact, I think their last transmission of HIV in the talent pool was more than 10 years ago. So we're, I think it was 2012.
But it wasn't on set.
But it was not on set. It was just in the pool. Of
I was actually, yeah. I don't know. I think I can talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a thing that happened. It's partly why we actually have 14-day testing now. Yeah. But I did a scene for Kink years and years ago. I think that was it. Yeah, 2012. Where the other talent was, so long story short, okay, I'll just wrap this up. So we did this scene. It was a public disgrace scene, and it was just like, where it's like a big party, and then there's a heavy kink scene going on in the middle of the party. So I was the male performer, the dom in that. The female talent, and her boyfriend that were there, I find out after the scene, because like I said, we test all the time, all that stuff. I'd actually gotten cut, her tooth cut me. And so this made it extra scary, obviously. But there was a point in that where after that scene, like 3 days later, her and her boyfriend's test came back positive. And it was a very scary time. Mm. And then I ended up, some people went on the news and like different radio things and said that I was the one who infected them and all this shit.
Oh, Jesus.
And it was insane. So like my whole career halted, my whole like life. It was very suicidal times for me. And I was terrified. And then, so I was testing every other day or every day to see if that was the case. And then after about a week of testing every day, and then all that, like, all these stories and stuff were circulating about me being the one who passed this to people. And it's a really, really hard time to think about. But finally, you know, I started just posting my tests on social media with my real name and all that shit. And I was just like, you know, putting that out there, like, hey, this is not me. And I can't believe that somebody would blame me. You know what I mean? It was a whole thing. But,
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was very, very involved.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to was the story planted or what was, that's very strange that would.
Well, I think that the people who said that about me were just scared and didn't want to be blamed for what had happened.
Interesting.
And so I think they saw me as an easy target in their eyes, I guess, to try to put the blame on. Wow. So yeah. That was a thing.
Well, and I heard you you guys on a space like a week or so ago, and Zandy, you made the point like the absurdity of saying like this is my it's violating my HIPAA rights for if whether I'm tested or not. Like in porn, you kind of see like that doesn't fly.
Yeah. So I want to say this: we are a very well regulated industry when it comes to self regulation. This is part of the issue that we're having right now is that we have this board called PASS, which is a performer safety board. They were getting, so we have these testing laboratories that you can use that PASS certified that performers said, you know, these are the tests we need. These are the tests to keep us safe. PASS created them, or PASS, I guess, didn't create them, but they standardized them between the labs. And then both of those labs decided, well, we have the trust of the industry. We're the only industry around that does these tests. So we're going to leave PASS, which is a nonprofit oversight board. Why should we want to be regulated by PASS? Why should we follow their rules? And now PASS doesn't get alerts when people's tests don't clear.
Yeah.
And a clear test would mean you're clear to go on set and work. And everybody I have ever known, you know, I'm really lucky because I came in kind of as a content creator, and the people who were working with me as a even though I was not like a main porn star, I wasn't doing anything with studios, they were very much like, no, these are the rules, these are the standards, this is what you're gonna hear too. These are like our testing standards, these are our testing bodies, this is like how we stay safe. And people really like took me under their wing, and like they taught me, which was really kind. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so and we PASS is the one, like, so PASS should be able to call a filming moratorium whenever we are unable to work because there are people testing positive, not clearing their tests, but in our talent pool. And because our two major testing companies, which are Talent Testing and Cutting Edge Testing, pulled out and decided they don't want to be governed anymore and they don't want to send any more information to PASS, we are in a lot of like kind of danger at this point.
Man.
I mean, I want you to think about this, like the oversight committee doesn't get any more data from any of these places. And so if we were to need to do a moratorium, now we don't know it.
Well, that's how this happened.
That is exactly how this happened.
This new thing. The thing I was talking about before, what happened to me, was two other people came up positive for HIV that I worked with, and they blamed me for it. Yeah.
But I guarantee you.
This is what we're talking about, is the chlamydia gonorrhea thing.
What I guarantee you, whenever this happened, PASS shut down the industry so that they could make sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so they could make, that's why we have PASS, right? So, oh my gosh, there was someone with HIV who's in our talent pool. Well, we're going to, we got that test back to PASS. We're going to close down the industry. Nobody's going to phone anything.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to shoot so that we can make sure we're very well self-regulated, right? Like, we're going
to
make sure that this
We have to be.
Yeah. Like, we're going to make sure that this doesn't get passed on to somebody. Nobody else gets exposed to this, that it was just these two people that came in and got exposed somewhere along the line, not on the set, and then that they can't pass it to anyone else. And so it's a huge issue that our testing agencies decided they just don't want to be regulated anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's about
any kind of rationale.
Yeah. Who's behind that decision? Is it the agencies themselves?
No. Agencies? No. It is the talent. It is Talent Testing and Cutting Edge Testing. These are two private laboratory companies.
Mm-hmm.
They decided they do not want to be regulated by the board that certified them as the place we could go in the first place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to have to listen to them, and they don't want an oversight committee. And so now they want to be able to do whatever they want. And that does not feel safe to a lot of performers. Like, how do we know that they're, how do we know what kind of tests they're going to use? Are they going to be the best test? How do we know where they're sending our samples now? Like, how do we know when a large number of people or any people are testing positive in our performer pool? Are we going to get notified, alerted? Because they're not sharing data to PASS, which is the oversight board.
And so speaking on the like PASS moratoriums in the past, I remember days like we were literally on set shooting for browsers and like, because there's been false positives, right? There's not been false negatives, but there's been false positives. And I remember, like, literally, the spaceship was about to dock, if you know what I mean. And, like, it was right there, and then all of a sudden, a PA comes running in, like, stop. Like, we just got a fucking email from PASS that there is, and they never said who, they just said, hey.
Yeah, we don't know who.
Yeah, there was a performer who tested positive for HIV or whatever. So we're going to call, you know, and so the production companies, like, especially MindGeek, browsers, they were just like, yeah, okay, we're done. Everybody go home. Like, we can eat lunch and hang out, but everybody has to, no fluid exchange. And then, you know, 2 or 3 days later, we find out it was a false positive. But that isn't a problem. Like, like that, I want an industry that's that fucking serious about it, that even if there's a chance that it's not the case, that we stop and protect people.
Right.
And also, I'll say, you know, with browsers, specifically like the MindGeek, the companies I work for, we had, you know, when the pandemic kicked off, all the crew and director had to wear masks on set. Like, that was how that was. Like, they all had the masks on. And before that, man, it's funny because it's like sometimes the site, the ads you see on the side of porn sites, I'm in a lot of those. But like, there's some of them that I shot with my fucking cell phone. Because Brazzers was like, hey, we don't want to have crew on set. We're going to have you. And was that ours? No, ours was a crew. Cody and I's first scene was on our phones. But so browsers would send me a script and be like, hey, here's what we want. Here's how we want everything to be. And literally they would do it like almost like a CIA safe house drop off. Like it was like, they would set up all the equipment inside, wipe it down and then leave and then be like, okay, you guys can come and enter the house now. And so then we would enter the house, set up the cameras, all the lights and stuff, and those stands would already be set up. We'd set the phones up and shoot exactly what they wanted us to shoot, like that. And so it was a really interesting way of like keeping it going, but like trying to be as safe as they could while maintaining content flow. But the, like, so, I mean, MindGeek definitely took a shit ton of steps to try. And they also were covering people's tests and all that stuff for COVID tests. Because up until, like, we stopped all of a sudden giving a shit about COVID, MindGeek had basically, there was a point where it was a fucking 24-hour test. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how serious it was. Like, to the point where I was getting COVID tested, like, three times a week. Like, it was like, all right. You know, it was a lot. And so, like, that was, you know, that was, and even after that, MindGeek was, you know, the last ones to go to 7 days, the last ones to go to 14 day and, like, all that stuff. So they were, and obviously, I mean, it's a huge corporation. It's basically the Disney of porn. Like, they just own everything. So obviously they're watching their asses legally and stuff all the time, right, too. But it did make us feel, as like, a, like contract performers especially, it made us feel a lot safer.
Xander's contract with them, and I would say like MindGeek is obviously they've sinned plenty in this, in this industry, right? Yeah. Back in the day, and some of the things that they have done maybe previously with like Pornhub are not great. But I can also tell you that they're one of the only industries that I've ever, the only companies I've ever seen do anything to address it. Right. Like when people were saying, hey, like there's revenge porn up on Pornhub, there's like depictions of CSA on Pornhub. You know, the people that are in charge right now made a big effort to switch that and to change that. I mean, and it's been, you know, probably 12 years of them, you know, and I'm going to talk a little bit about CSA because I always feel like this topic comes up when we talk about sex work, talk about pornography. The biggest hosts of CSA on the internet is Facebook. But you will see right-wing groups and evangelicals come after MindGeek, come after Pornhub, come after a place where a lot of people make their money. And they were very successful in that. They got MasterCard and Visa to stop utilizing that as a being able to use MasterCard and Visa on the Pornhub platform. The only thing that happened was that legitimate models with IDs on the site now can't make money on it. Yeah. Nothing else happened. And you ask yourself, I mean, I ask myself, you know, as somebody who has definitely worked with victims of CSA and definitely we interface with people who are victims of trafficking, we have people
through your therapist.
People who've been victims of trafficking also in our organization. You know, I think there's a lot of people who ask, you know, how did that help people who were victims of trafficking to take away money from legitimate models with IDs on the site? And that's been something that I've seen MindGeek as a brand like move towards over many, many years, right? Like being more ethical, being there for the models, performers, et cetera, and in some ways, like, really helping workers. Right now, what we're talking about with testing, too, is also, like, a worker safety thing. To me, this seems like we have to kind of band together and be like, we need worker safety. This is another piece of worker safety. We need it at our job, you know?
There was some people also in one of the spaces that was basically, they were like, because MindGeek is one of the major, like, contributors to the PASS thing. And they were like basically saying like, well, how can we trust it if there's a major corporation that's the one giving all the money to it? And it's like,
yeah, okay. The thing is like industry standards.
Like, I don't understand. Like, right. It's like, I'm no corporate shill, but like, cause I have had meetings with MindGeek, like board meetings where I'm just up Bernie Sanders yelling at the fucking table. About like how we should be doing things and why this is wrong. Like I had one where it was like a bunch of the like the head people like or the like corporate people, and basically I had this grievance about set safety because it was a long time ago. I shot a scene where it was in this gym that was just a gym, and there was nobody in the gym obviously except for us that were shooting there, and it was an anal scene with a girl. and there was no showers, and they didn't wipe down this. Like, literally, when I asked them to wipe down the gym equipment, they used baby wipes. And I was like, how old are you? Like, what the fuck is happening here? Mm-hmm. Like, baby wipes aren't, what are you doing? Like, this is, and so basically, like, I was like, we should not have to shoot on a set, or at least be informed beforehand that there is not a shower here. Like, mm-hmm. We need to have a place where we can actually, like, clean ourselves. Like, this is, that's ridiculous. So, even, and, you know, it's happened before, it's happened since then, but, like, 90, I would say, I mean, we don't really shoot on locations anymore that much, but, like, they always try to provide you with a place. They'll even, if you ask them to get you a hotel room so that you can shower off, they'll do mm-hmm. that. Because we had another scene where a girl, God, we were shooting this scene with these female talent in Florida, and Florida is a place that exists. But basically, we had this outdoor scene in a Jeep with me and these three girls, and the one girl had to fly home that day. And basically, these fucking idiots who have been since reprimanded and dealt with in Florida wanted her to complete this scene and then just take her to the airport. So, like, four of us having sex outside in fucking muggy-ass Florida.
That's right.
And, you know, covered in all fun juice, and then just be like, okay, we'll take you to the airport now. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like,
I've definitely been at the airport in that situation. I'm definitely like, you're in the airport.
What the fuck, dude? And so, like, I, you know, these are, like, things that I, like, brought up in these meetings, and, you know, they listen, Mind Geek will listen to performances, basically what I'm getting.
Well, like, and the point I want to make about that is, like, industry standards can be sort of self interested, but like that's good, like, right?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely, yes. You know?
And like, and we also exist in a world that those hard fought for, like by people like yourself, and learned lessons that can be forgotten. And that's what it seems like is happening mm-hmm. with this whole testing thing. Like, oh, what's the worst that could happen? We're just, I can't believe, like, are they saying like this is for efficiency? Like, or are they just like, peace, we're just, we don't want to play anymore?
I can tell you the story that I've been told, it costs money, of course, to like be reporting. It has to be like someone's whole job basically to like be reporting to this agency, right?
Mm,
like,
yeah.
What's the benefit for them? They have to hire somebody who like transfers this data and like handles this data to PASS and then interfaces with PASS. That doesn't really, there's no monetary benefit in that for them. So why would they do it? Yes. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is that PASS is a nonprofit. So they go around and they certify labs that can meet our standards. And we do have some specific standards, right? We need the most sensitive HIV test in all of existence. We need two kinds of syphilis tests. We like, so they run double. We only use an Aptima combo 2 Panther assay. I shouldn't know this, but I do. Cause I called a laboratory this morning and asked them, for gonorrhea and chlamydia, right? Like those are the things mm-hmm. we need. And we have to have these really specific turnaround times, 24 hours or less. So PASS went around trying to find some other labs. Maybe there's some labs that are nonprofits. Maybe there's some labs that would be less costly for performers because our tests are really expensive.
Yeah, they are.
Now they're more.
Now they're more. But it's cheaper than the industry shutting down. So yeah.
It's cheaper than not working. So they went around trying to find some laboratories that they could also include. And they got a couple of laboratories on board. And my understanding from people that I think no reason to lie to me was that Talent Testing specifically wanted to sit on their nonprofit board. And they said, yeah. No, we're a nonprofit and we don't want a corporation sitting on our board. And as a result, they said when PASS said no, Talent Testing pulled out of PASS.
Yeah.
And this is actually the second time they pulled out of PASS. They were pressured to rejoin before. But they pulled out in October, and then in November, talents are like, something's wrong. A mm-hmm. bunch of people we know are testing positive. We're not sure what's going on. Tons and tons of sets are being canceled. What's going on? And it's funny because we said something to actually both Talent Testing and CET, who have put out the most gaslighting statements ever, telling us that that isn't happening. Like that we're making it up. That, you know, I talked to someone who's a talent coordinator for Brazzers, who said that in the month of November that she had fielded more than 100 calls from people who were trying to, who were saying that they were exposed and had to reschedule their shoot because they didn't mm-hmm. know if they were positive and needed to get retested or that they were positive.
Yeah.
But like 100 calls, she personally Like, mm-hmm. I have known more than a dozen people who have had this issue, so I know what the problem is, right? I know that's something literally in 1 month pulled out of our only organization that did contact tracing and told us if we needed to be worried and needed to shut down the industry. They pulled out, and then all of a sudden we have problems, and it's not a shocker.
Well, and also I think one of the other things leading that to the money thing, them having to run tests on the swabs that we use now would be more expensive for them as well. So, I mean, I think that's a factor in that too.
There's also pressure from PASS, that our board and our organization, because there's pressure from performers mm-hmm. for them to lower the cost of these things, right? Because we are testing twice a month. So there's a big push where we're like, you know, this is too expensive. You make so much money off of us. Like
literally millions and millions of dollars. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, Xander Corvus, X Corvus 777 on Twitter, and Summer Heart, HARTXXX on Twitter. Well, for as long as you guys are allowed on Twitter, as long as any of us are, I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
Bender the other day, right?
Yeah. They did, but hey, you can't keep us down. So Bender is back on. I mean, Elon can't really get anything to stick. It seems at this point. But, thank you both so much for joining us. Anything else, Suede? Where should people direct their energies?
So Suede is a mutual aid group for sex workers, and we don't just mean people that do porn. We mean anybody who utilizes their sexuality to make a living. So that would include dancers, full-service sex escorts, and phone sex operators, and I don't know, lots and lots of people. And basically what we do is we give out microgrants. So people, we don't do means testing, which is like Miriam Sanders' influence here, right? We don't do means testing. We trust people with like why they need it. I'm not saying it's unlimited, but you know, we give what we can to people who are in need. We have a request form right now. We actually, should come live today. It hasn't come live today yet. We are trying to help performers with a small subsidy for their testing, since their testing is going to cost more, and lots of people need to be swabbed right now because of what's been going on. So we have a new form for that, so people can request a subsidy from us. And we also do harm reduction supplies. So like, you need Plan B, you need Narcan, you need fentanyl test strips, you need clean needles, you need just basically stuff to keep you alive and safe. And by the way, I do, because I saw this on YouTube, people being like, they're promoting sex and drugs. No, I am not. There are some people who have
saying that we are.
Yes,
that's awesome.
There are people who have sex for money, and I think those people deserve to be full human beings who have rights, protections, and have things to make their work safe. And I also believe that drug users don't deserve to die. Mm-hmm. Too many of us have lost friends and people that we know. I lost somebody this year. Like we need to, as a community, we had the ability as a nonprofit to become a Narcan distributor for the state. So we did. We see people who are, you know, using substances as comrades and believe, I don't know, weirdly, fucking radically, I guess, that they don't deserve to die of overdoses. I have gotten the most hate mail and the most nasty shit sent to me on Instagram over giving people Narcan. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, we will give you condoms. We will give you Plan B. We will give you Narcan, fentanyl test strips. We will try to get you other stuff too, including clean needles. If you email us or go to our website, there's a request form for harm reduction supplies. And we do other stuff. Like, I don't know, we help somebody have an abortion through abortion hosting. We help people move. I don't know. We do what we can for the community when we can, right? One time we drove to Arizona to pick a girl up. I don't know. We give people bus passes. Like, it's mutual aid. The way we have some, you know, structured stuff, and then we do try to like help instead of our community in whatever ways we can, you know.
It's wonderful.
That sounds
that's the problem with these fucking radical leftists, dude. They want to help people. We can't have
They want to keep people alive and make sure folks are okay.
They're out there thinking that everybody's equal and deserves a shot at an enjoyable life. That's,
I mean, when do we decide who deserves to die? I don't know. What part of politics is that? That's great. Suede Vegas, thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
Yeah. Yes. I had a bubble in my throat. Yes, folks.
Welcome trying to do back, a nice smooth intro.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, welcome. That was great. They were guys. Wonderful. Yeah, it really was a lot of fun. And there's more. We should remind folks.
Yes.
We had to cut that one for time. The full interview is about an hour, 20 minutes, and we'll put it up right after the post game. So there's some important stuff there too, particularly around like trans inclusion and things like that, that you should definitely check out if you liked what you saw.
Absolutely.
Well, let's, we're going to go to the post game in just a second, but there's a story I want to follow up on, because it's something we covered on this program when the first round of it came out, which is the really disgusting headline, just to be upfront, about child labor in Alabama. And, if folks want to see, we did a full report on that on Left Reckoning a few months ago when the first story came out. I can't remember the title off the top of my head. Some, you know, child labor in Alabama, I'm assuming is, you know, you'll be able to find it through the YouTube search stuff. But there's more, unfortunately, and it's not that the federal government is getting involved dealing with Hyundai and Kia. In fact, it's worse. A Reuters investigation, child workers found throughout Hyundai Kia supply chain in Alabama. Just reminding folks, we covered this on this program. It was revealed that there were multiple instances of underage workers working throughout different Hyundai and Kia facilities in the state of Alabama. And this report that just came out from Reuters just a few days ago shows that not only, you know, reaffirms what was first found, there's more. I'll just read a little bit from it. At least four major suppliers of Hyundai Motor Company and sister Kia Corp have employed child labor at Alabama factories in recent years, a Reuters investigation found. And state and federal agencies are probing whether kids have worked at as many as half a dozen additional manufacturers throughout the automaker's supply chain in the southern United States. At a plant owned by Hisshin America Corp, a supplier to the two car brands in the South Alabama town of Greenville, a 14-year-old Guatemalan girl worked this May assembling auto body components, according to interviews with her father-in-law enforcement officials. At plants owned by Korean auto parts maker Ajin Industrial Company in the East Alabama town of Cusetta, a former production engineer told Reuters he worked with at least 10 miners, and six other ex-employees of Ajin said they too worked alongside multiple underage laborers. In two separate statements sent by the same public relations firm, Hashin and Ajin said their policies forbid the hiring of any worker not of legally employable age. Using identical language, both companies said they hadn't, to the best of our knowledge, hired underage workers. Just rat talk from them. You know, you don't just accidentally hire, you know, a dozen plus underage workers without knowing that, you know, if you're not, you know, catching it up front, you certainly are not doing enough to verify and check these things. And, you know, a lot of these workers are people who have, you know, questionable documentation status, are from poor families who are trying to find a way to, you know, squeeze by in a system that is crushing them. And these companies are very happy to utilize, you know, their labor. And, you know, it's disgusting in any level. If it's like a burger stand, you know, at the beach and there's a 14-year-old working there, right? Despicable. But this is like heavy machinery, yeah. Extremely dangerous work. And, you know, it's truly, truly horrendous that major car companies are doing this in Alabama. And as we're seeing, you know, there's possibility that this might be more widespread. And I wouldn't be surprised if it if it was, given how much they found from this one probe here.
Yeah, the child labor thing and the migrant labor angle of this make this just, I mean, you talk about races to the bottom, mm-hmm. Who found it. Alabama found the bottom. They're there. And the thing is every one of these people should be given immediate citizenship for their services to American specific kind of productivity. And every one of these CEOs should be put in jail. Like this sort of thing is it's like that they know that this is rife for this sort of abuse. And like it's caught now. You know, who knows how rife this is across other factories and other supply chain things. But like that, it takes a amount of balls to do this. Mm-hmm. And it's astounding.
And just to give another reaction to this, this is from our friends at the Value Labor Report in Alabama reacting to this same story.
The latest is just basically that there's more suppliers in the Hyundai Motor Company supply chain that have been caught using child labor. So previously there were two. There was one outside of Montgomery in Laverne, and there was one outside of Mobile. That was SL Alabama. Smart Alabama was outside of Montgomery. Well, now there is a plant owned by Huaxin America Corp, which is a supplier to Hyundai, in the South Alabama town of Greenville, and a plant owned by Agent Industrial Company in the East Alabama town of Cassetta. Both of these have been revealed to have been utilizing child labor, children under the age of 16, in manufacturing environments. I mean, you know, again, just like the plants outside of Mobile and outside of Montgomery, these are manufacturing environments.
And, you know, it's one of those things that is difficult to sort of reckon with when we're trying to fight for a workers' democracy in this country, that we're fighting both against, for example, the federal government deciding that some workers, rail workers, aren't allowed to strike and they're going to get involved. And then right now fighting against literal child labor in manufacturing. And I think, you know, you got to hit that time and time again. It's what we're talking about here. And it's classic. You know, I think it's important to remember, too, a lot of these car companies that have been moving to the South are moving to the South because they think that they can get away with more labor violations. They think that they can get away from unionized workforces, and they think that they can continue a kind of race to the bottom. So when you hear these GOP politicians be like, I'm so happy we brought this plant down to our community, blah, blah, blah. They're not doing it because they want to invest in the community. They're not doing it because they want to, you know, provide a better life for folks. They're doing it because they think that they can take advantage of you, right?
Yeah, and they gave a corporation a good deal on some labor.
Yeah. So we'll definitely be trying to follow up on that, but figured it was worth, following up on again, and like I would like the next story to be the Biden administration getting involved coming at Kia and Hyundai, but part of me feels like this is going to be something like, I'm sure there'll be some reckoning and punishment for it, don't get me wrong, but swept under the rug. Well, before we roll, I wanted to play a very brief clip of somebody talking about labor, and I think doing a damn good job. Somebody who Matt and I are big fans of, Mick Lynch in the UK. Quick clip. I just think this is somebody who, you know, for me, like somebody who tries to talk about these issues, you know, in this medium, I'm always impressed by how concise, clear, and pointed he can be with these things. This is Mick Lynch on, I think it's BBC.
Tax is not just about income, it's about accumulated wealth, which is usually accumulated off the work of other people. The rich don't create wealth in this country, it is the workers of this society that create all wealth, and they should get a fair redistribution of that. And if Labour could do one thing, it could put redistribution on the front of its manifesto, and they'd get massive support. Tax is...
Well, we know what position Labour should take. Yeah, they definitely jumped down his throat on that. I mean, this is a very clear point, and I actually think is something that distinguishes, for example, leftists or socialists, trade unionists maybe, from like everyday liberals. You hear conversations in American politics in particular, and UK is not too different. All the things that are happening right now, both on like social fights and on economic fights, when you look at the economic fight in this country and you look at the two major parties and you look at what the difference in their program is, at the end of the day, it's just twiddling around the edges. It's like, what's the tax rate? What should the tax rate be on the rich, Matt? Should it be 25% or should it be 20%, right? Like, that's where politics is when it comes to the economy in the United States. And Mick Lynch is not only saying, but he's absolutely saying, like, we should be taxing and redistributing it, but also making the moral case. It's not just like, oh, well, we're going to take this from the rich people and give it to the poor people. It's saying that is stuff that has been taken off the backs of labor. And making that point is something that you don't get from your typical Democratic Party politician.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is the big time difference, is we can't be piddling that. And look, I agree that I would like to go back to post-New Deal marginal tax rates.
Yeah.
But there's a reason that shit got clawed back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will say, mm-hmm. sorry, no. If you had something on topic.
I was just going to say, it's always good to see a professional like a Lynch, you know.
Yeah. I will say the level of, I think I've come to a level of maturity where when I hear people say labor creates all wealth, Matt and I did a thing, you can watch it on the Critique of the Gotha program, where Marx very passionately critiques that slogan. And I've started to be like, we can hold that criticism be true and also understand why rhetorically that does work.
Yeah.
I get too worked up about it. Anyways, folks, we're going to jump over to the post game. I got a lot of energy right now. It won't be too long. Probably 5-10 minutes. And, we got fun stuff. We got, Tim Pool and, Charlie Kirk breaking down the problem of wokeness in America. Matt's got three things.
The number three ranking Republican in the House is a big crypto guy. And I just found some massively cringe stuff he did in a previous failed run for office. And, you're going to want to be joining us. I'll tease a little bit more. A guy who got in trouble for saying the minimum wage should be lowered on tipped employees because they sometimes make six figures, then went and did a video where he waitered at a Mexican restaurant. So we'll be watching that in the postgame.
And we'll be taking your calls and questions. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-940-289-7234. Please consider being a patron.
Yes.
It really helps us continue to grow. We had a bit of a drop, so we went under 1,000. Unfortunately, we're two away. So if you've been a long-time listener, you haven't signed up for the Patreon, you haven't been getting this bonus content, right now seems like a damn good time. Help us get over 1,000. We'd really appreciate that. We'll be over in the postgame 5-10 minutes, taking your calls, questions, talking about crypto, and all of these other weird right-wing nonsensical things. And we'll be back this Sunday with a bonus episode for patrons and the rest of y'all next Tuesday at 7. So take care.
Peace.